Sorry. Can we have comments from people we haven't heard from so far? Don't be shy. Yes. Can you identify yourself?
Yes, I'm John Ellis. I'm born in London, but currently working in San Francisco for the last 25 years. I found this an absolutely fascinating experience, this conference, and I really want to congratulate Ricky and everyone who was involved with it, because it's been such an interesting experience to see these, first of all, these big projects, but also to have the dialogue not only with architects and urban designers, but with mayors and decision makers at the same time. And I think the point that I would very much like to make, having seen these big projects, is the need for them to be considered now as part of urban fabric and not as separate enclaves. I think Eric's comment about Canary Wharf is very timely and very valid, because if one looks at what's happening out in the Docklands and what may well occur in the sort of Royal Docks area, is a huge privatized world separated by massive arterial roads and enormous roundabouts and walled off communities. In contrast, say, to the fabric of the West End of London, where you can walk continuously from Paddington Station all the way down to Victoria through neighborhoods which are continuously connected. And if one looks at the pattern in London of the great estates, even though they were designed as separate elements, they all integrate one way or another. There are always links and such like between them. And I think the big challenge with these mega projects here is how to create the links into the surrounding communities so that they're not self-contained, privatized, isolated enclaves. And I think that's a really an important issue that it would be very interesting to see at a future conference examples of finer-grained pieces of the city, and maybe even have an exhibition of case studies to show how that could be demonstrated. There was a very interesting point, I think, made by Joanna about the precedent in Vancouver, where Larry Beasley there, who is a brilliant planner, works for the city and takes the initiative. That city has an advanced planning unit whereby the planning department plans the city, lays out the ground rules, and even establishes the building types that are allowed, for example, the very tall, slender residential towers and street wall-holding buildings. And it's very interesting to see that that type of thinking is occurring, or beginning to occur here in London, whereby the GLA will be an initiative taker rather than just reacting. And I think that, again, could be a very interesting issue to discuss further.
I'm Nigel Hugill. As I said yesterday, I've been involved in a lot of the projects in London as a property developer, and I'm proud to call myself a property developer. And on Friday night, if you'd asked me, I would have said that at the moment we were in a gilded age. I now, having listened to the last 2 days, would offer the suggestion that actually we're in the second great urban age, the first one being the Victorian age. And I think in understanding a lot of what's happening in marshalling between the majority of the time that you spend thinking about things and the majority of the way that I spend thinking about things, the dynamics of that Victorian age are really quite profound. And the starting point for that is that actually I occupy a world where there is no shortage of capital. There is a shortage of projects. And when I started at Stratford 7 years ago on a set of proposals that eventually turned into a scheme that would have a £4 billion construction cost, it never occurred to me that I wouldn't be able to fund it. Because in this age, you can fund that. That having been said, it being subsumed within the Olympics and the support of the GLA for the project from the start was fundamental in that process, and actually the reason that people like Nikki and the mayor put their shoulders behind it really very early on was one of the reasons that I was prepared to continue. Because that in turn comes from the fact that what I've learned over the last 15 years is that big projects are not exponentially more difficult than small projects. So you may as well do big projects, not least because you're more likely to be invited to urban age conferences. And but just finishing on Stratford and picking up the point about pylons, one of the things that I can't do on my own account, I can fund £4 billion, but I can't bury the pylons. And that was the interplay between the two that was necessary. And that was one of the fundamental elements that took it over. And just going back to...
Just
on the second point, just because I think it's important too, in relation to the four mega projects that you've been looking at, I now am on a short list of two to develop the Elephant Castle. And I would suggest that actually the Elephant Castle and King's Cross are two projects that don't need to be mega projects. They shouldn't be mega projects. And in fact, my proposals at Elephant Castle are completely for scaling down the whole thing. Whereas there is an argument that White City and at Stratford, what you did need was that huge kickstart. And that's, I think that's one of the distinctions that you've also got to look at.
Right. That's a very useful intervention. And the issue between the two of you is that for you, fine grain is necessarily small scale. And I think what you're asking us to think about is that maybe the scale and grain are not so inversely correlated. That's an interesting issue. One to which I think Nicholas Olsberg, who has just put his hand up in the back, has... But could you respond to this, because you know about this?
Well, I know about Larry Beasley and Vancouver and the impossibility of constructing anything for delight in the terms that he's established, and the rigidity that is resulting from in the street systems of downtown Vancouver as a result, and the impossibility of walking along a street and seeing somebody else because of the high to low proportions he's developed. It wasn't actually what I wanted to talk about. But I think what I want to talk about may sound irrelevant, but I think it's relevant. It seems to me, and I've enjoyed it enormously, and I've been stimulated a lot by the questions raised all about the two portions of the Vitruvian proposition, the usefulness and the viability of what we do and what designers do, and its instrumentality, the possibility of it being an agent for desegregation of the cities or for the mixing of communities, the questions about whether that needs to be complicit or coerced, whether the designer is complicit or interventionist in that situation, and so on and so forth. But the third proposition, Vitruvian proposition, I haven't heard much about. I've heard an enormous anxiety about cities. I've heard an enormous and very thoughtful worrying and puzzling about their problems. And the question of pleasure has not emerged. It seems to me that the great visions of cities are of visions of delight, visions of visual delight, visions of various delights. That pleasure is not uniformly one thing to all cultures or to one individual. And I hope that you draw a map of some of these high intensity zones so I can avoid them, because I don't get pleasure out of them. But I also hope that you'll draw a map of the city as a source, as a generator of pleasures of its own. And those pleasures are very complex, and I thought your statement poetic and very profound indeed. That there is a complex in a layering to pleasure. A pleasure derives from a visible memory that one can recapture and see. It doesn't have to be an old building. It has to be a memory of that something that looks like a World War II film of London, and it means something to me. Pleasure can derive from being alone in a street and finding a time to be so. And designers know how to make pleasure. We don't know whether they can change society, or whether they can be co-opted or partner with others to make. But we do know that they have visions of delight and visions of society enjoying that visual delight. And I would encourage us as well to think that the city is not just a place of anxiety, but a source of enormous hope and aspiration and expression of aspiration, and a place that can be wonderful fun to look at and to be in. And it may sound irrelevant, but I think it's worth saying.
Yes, you were.
I wanted to pick up on the theme that Nicholas just left on. It's Patricia Brown, Central London Partnership. I wanted to challenge the issue that you have to build difficult into making successful cities, and particularly in the context of London where we're sitting at the moment. I think one person's edge is another person's no-go zone, and there's too many parts of London at the moment which actually suffer from being those no-go zones. And as a consequence, I think London is in a very vulnerable position at the moment, picking up on Sophia's point, not just from terrorism, but from people making choices about how they want to spend their lives, how and where they actually find the delight that Nicholas is talking about. And it ain't King's Cross. And there's an awful lot of parts of pure central London where they're actually avoiding because it isn't providing them a delightful experience. And as a consequence, it's ripping the economic heart out of London. The West End springs to mind. It is the most notable example of that, which is why the retailers and the property developers are spending £750,000 on a master plan, putting back the fine grain of the city in order to actually bring people back into the place and create a place where people feel it's for them. So I do think London's reaching a tipping point at the moment, and it frightens me to hear the city talk about of only being successful if it's more complicated. Diverse, absolutely. But it's how we design in delight and how we design in diversity and how do we design in ease of movement and experience, I think, which will keep London moving forward.
I'm Gordana Fontana-Giusti from Central St. Martin's College of Art and Design. As part of this thing, a lot of people have asked me in this conference, like, are you an architect? Are you an artist? Or, I'm an architect. And it's part of also this knowledge communities. There is a knowledge community within the Central St. Martin's that is trying to address some of these issues. And there is this urban research and design group that I'm leading at the moment. So that's just a quick point. I wanted to say something about this dichotomy, which seems to be like the general question that the conference seems to address, and that is this relationship between the social and the physical. And I don't know, and I apologize if I'm missing some of the previous sessions in the background, but I just wanted to think about it for a moment. It seems to me what comes also in a discussion and the interventions like Patricia just made, or like a gentleman behind me, or indeed Eric and indeed Gita earlier this afternoon, there is another category that keeps on emerging, which can't quite be reduced to either social or physical, and that is the category of the experience, of personal experience. And you, Richard, you have also started your presentation by introducing that category. So, well, that category is addressed by, you know, various people in the seminar. It is not formally incorporated in the question. And while some people would think that that category might be within the category of the social, I'm actually trying to make a point that that category can't be subsumed within the category of the social. It has to be addressed separately. And in a way, if we can learn something from the failings of the urbanism in the 60s and 70s, it's precisely that that category was not addressed. The category of the experience was not addressed as such, but was assumed within the category of the social. And I think we can only gain from that. And that also comes, the need to introduce that category could be also seen in this unconscious need that people want to have a designer, want to have an architect who they somehow see like an agent who will bring this category of the experience into the whole process of design and start the role bowling, which is indeed the task of the architect, to sort of personalize it and make the whole kind of task addressed on that level of the individual as well. But I think for the clarity, it's quite useful to introduce it. And I could also refer just to one person who actually does formally introduce it. And that's, I do apologize if I'm quoting the darling of the architects, Félix Guattari, but I'm referring to a text which is not normally referred to, because Plato is the famous text that all architects refer to, Deleuze and Guattari. But there is one very small and not so well known, three are ecologists text, where he actually makes precisely that point. That category of the individual experience has to be introduced as a kind of another category in the ecology, in the three ecologies that are needed, and that's the social, the environmental, and the individual.
Well, may I contribute a little bit? What Richard Sennett said before, enriching people's experience is pointing toward an evolution. This is direction of the evolution, and evolution works on trial and error, or expectations and experience. This is the way how evolution works, and the city is a big artificial body is driven by the desires of people. As long as it was driven by the desires of people without technical means, the European city was the result. Otherwise, you couldn't escape. So you had to socialize with the other people. And then, during the last, I would say, 200 years, technical development has changed the pace of the development. And the city, the American city, is driven by the desires of car drivers. So the space and time of car drivers is quite different to space and time of humans. And the social bodies has also changed because the human dimension couldn't follow. And we get the cracks also in the social body. I think this is one of the problems we are facing today. If we go to the sustainability concept, we need a closed feedback to the receptors of our society. And the society react, which means the people react. This is the pain, how the urban body feels mistakes in one of the elements. And one of the pains could be also a wrong physical structure. And if the physical structure have big cracks or not the right size, you get big cracks in the social structure also, and in these big cracks, all the problems or some of the problems can arise. I think it's a question of pace of the development of technical development compared to human development, and we have a little bit be too naive concerning technical development. And as soon as we are able, and we didn't know, of course. I have quite the opposite position to Alejandro. I think we know 0.5%, and we don't know 99 point and something like. This is my position. And I think we, just coming back to urban planning, I think we must be aware that we are making mistakes. And I think we must accept to learn out of these mistakes. And this is very important, because the effects of mistakes in the urban fabric can last for decades. And we have to widen our view, and the question has already been raised during the last 2 days. We have to analyze what has happened, because evolution never forgets. This is not only trial and error and expectation and experience. This is a cycle where always informations are stored.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I want to take back something you said before to a response to your question. We had at the beginning of this meeting, and it got unfortunately rather lost. We have a text from the mayor of Barcelona about the European city model, and unfortunately we didn't get a chance to really explore it. But his notion is this: that from the point of view that you're speaking about, or that Herman is speaking about in terms of pace, that The European city model is preferable, which is a model of compact, integrated space, is preferable for the experience of individuals than a model which is stretched out, disaggregated, and particularized. And there's a sentence in, if I remember it from this version or not, but if it's not in this, I'll tell you what it is. His argument is that individualized spaces provide less scope for individual experience than highly compacted, integrated spaces. And I'm very sensible to the point you make, but it has its reflection, as one close believes, in only a particular kind of urban form, that the intensity of experience requires density and it requires connection. And that the American city, to him, which is an individualized space, is not a space for individual experience. So the point you bring to us, and that you also bring in terms of you're much more organicist than I had ever understood about you, is that the reflection of this kind of urban value requires the defense of our kinds of cities from the kinds of cities a half a century ago we took as modal, which was this American model with increasing dispersion. So I'm sorry you weren't here yesterday morning, because this is you add a dimension to this for him which is absolutely crucial, which is that individualized spaces weaken individual experience. And this brings us back to, in a way, where we started at the beginning of this discussion.
What do you mean by individualized space?
The kind of individualized space you would think of in an American suburb is a house, sometimes what's called a McMansion, on a quarter acre lot with two or more cars in the front, no fences around it. Which requires you to drive a half an hour for a fresh lettuce, 2 hours to go to work, but it's a space that is totally privatized in the sense that you have to go inside it, you know, to be in it. It has no surround. It is the space of the American suburb. My lifetime became very fashionable at a certain point to say, well, these suburbs are fine. This is just these, you know, upper class snobs who don't, you know, like them.
What's the equivalent of the dense urban space problem?
You have to turn your...
Sorry, I'm slightly surprised we've moved suddenly, at least perhaps I haven't noticed something, we sort of moved into the suburbs. Because I was thinking that something you said before, which was pretty important, which was about large projects diminishing complexity, if I can just respond to that, the scale of the sort of developments that have been talked about today, if we take their commercial constituents, it does seem, for the time being, at any rate, as though developers believe that very large, pretty large buildings are here to stay and are the best kinds of buildings for commercial activity. But what's kind of interesting, even about these large building types, is that if you stop thinking of them in terms of plan form and you start thinking in terms of section, it's perfectly possible, actually, to design a layer of activity and even potentially complexity and economic diversity under certain conditions, which all happens at ground level. And some time ago, I kind of tried to formulate a kind of planning, town planning categorization, which was to consider the large commercial function in cities, which a prevalent function in our metropolis. And I'm not talking about the residential, I'm talking about purely the kind of culture of information technology and what goes on in offices. And to define that as what I'd call global transaction, and to make a distinction between that and what goes on at ground level, which we as human beings feel nurtures us, which is the locality of transaction, what we can actually find directly off the pavement, the small cafe, the shop, the bar, the small workshop, and so on. And I don't think those two kinds of activity are in any way architecturally in conflict with each other. It's a question, it's more a financial issue, really. And Spitalfields Market, I have slightly sore experience for me because I was sacked some time ago, 15 years ago, more or less, 12 years ago, whatever it was, for trying to introduce complexity into that. Actually, it has happened, roughly speaking.
Well, you raised two issues about this. One is, again, the scale question. The second is how much these structures, these mega projects, how much history they can have, whether, in fact, they can be, over the course of time, be made more complex, more convoluted, or whether the structures are dead, whether they inhibit that. You're going to have the last word, and then I will sum up.
Bob Allies, Allies & Morrison. We've been involved in both King's Cross and the Olympics. I think that the point I want to make about that, exactly that last issue, is that I think there's a sort of naivety sometimes when one looks at these projects, these large projects, and you look at the way in which they're drawn, and I know David said something like this earlier, that there's a sort of expectation that you're able to judge something from the drawings that are produced at this stage. I think for designers, they're not seen like that. That's not what you're designing. I feel that our role in these projects is always to a great extent that we're designing a process. We're brought in to listen to a large number of people. We hear a lot of aspirations, sometimes ones which concur, sometimes ones which are opposed to each other. And the phrase animateur actually is rather a good one, but I think that that is exactly the role of the architect or the master planner in this case, where you're trying to find ways in which a set of aspirations can be realized. Fascinatingly, from our point of view, is that those aspirations change enormously as time goes by. So in other words, because I happen to be doing this now, as opposed to 10 years ago, what I design is completely different. Nothing to do with what I think, just to do with the different contexts in which I work. And because we're designing a process, then it's really important that the design decisions you make reflect that process, that fact. Right. And there is an open-endedness in what you design. And in terms of making mistakes, I think there's a kind of key element, which is a point which I think these plans have in common now, which is that there is we are trying to avoid any confusion any longer between infrastructure and building, so that... Yeah. That we build something, it can be demolished, it can be taken away. We're not building in these long-term problems into the future.
Yes, well, I think that's good to hear. I mean, I think the problematic that we have is whether when you leave the process and the building is there, whether it's left in a form that somebody else can take up and revise significantly. Zhenming, I cut you off. No, speak.
I thought I could get away not having to say anything, being put on the spot. I've sort of got lost quite a bit just the last 2-3 days, hearing so much of the fascinating details. You know, for a student of Chinese cities or Asian cities to some extent, I find how do I sort of bootstrap myself out of the rich details. I think maybe a way I'll just sort of throw out a crazy idea, perhaps of making some sense of the what I see as really increasing similarities across these many cities that you would not expect, given their different political and cultural and economic context. you know, in terms of increasing transnational migration, the tension between the local residents and the minorities. I mean, the Shanghai context, even though, you know, it's not ethnic-based, but we see the tremendous problems there when we had a conference. I think maybe the way of thinking about the cities is, I think they're caught in between two competing, perhaps mutually reinforcing processes. One I would call integration, but more at a higher level, perhaps at a global level. We see cities that have been used in Sassi's notion sort of being you know, uprooted or relocated into a global networks of cities. But I think that's much less of a concern to me as a sociologist. It's really, I think the more the cities become perhaps integrated, the greater the local fragmentation that we see taking place. So I think they're mutually reinforcing and simultaneous. And that's, I think, the fundamental dilemma, you know, facing us, is how an increasing inability of government or governors to really reconcile that, you know, seemingly contradictory but yet inherently reinforcing processes that are unfolding at the same time. It's very difficult to see, you know, which of these processes will eventually win over. You know, the ultra-globalist would say globalization will eventually make us more alike, cities more alike. It's not a simple convergence argument, but I think it's sort of pointing in that direction. I think for us, I think the challenge, you know, for urban age is to look across these cities and figuring out to what extent, you know, these two processes can be disentangled and to what extent that you could devise strategies and ways of managing them and perhaps balancing them to the best combination for the benefits and interests of the local residents. I don't know whether that makes sense, but, you know, sort of.
It does make sense. We have two final short comments, and then I have a comment. Tony Travers.
Thank you, Richard. I mean, you posed a particular question about the European city model and the culture of intensity. And I think in the dying moments of this conference being in London, it is worth pointing out that, in a sense, everybody in this room, I think it's fair to say, implicitly shares the assumption that large cities, and often densely populated large cities, perhaps even more densely populated ones, are inherently a good thing. But in reality, in this particular large city, within this particular country, there is some evidence that that is not the case. I mean, British-born people are still leaving this particular city in very large numbers every year. And although, as we've established, they are being replaced, and they may be going to the outer edges of the southeast, creating an ever larger London, but they are leaving, and they are being replaced one for one by people moving in from overseas. And in a sense, the whole of the conference has accepted that these major projects, which are now more or less entirely designed for people not living in the UK today, that we've accepted the economic primacy of the city, of London, as a way of making money, and significantly underplayed the kind of service provision, the public services, which might just encourage fewer of these people to continue to get out. Now, I know all conferences can't be about everything, but in the end, the failures of the education system, the failures of the health service, the failures of the transport system, which the Olympics, bless it, is trying to do all at once, remain a significant underminer of the, they undermine the intensity argument in this particular city. And what do we have to do? We have to import people from other places who like London more than the people who live here. And we just need to understand that.
Thank you. Dieterin is would like a drink rather than to make a statement. I just want to say to you that I guess the image to carry away from this is, because we have to carry away from this, is what does the discussion we've had the two last days, what would it matter to somebody in Mexico City? A city which now, by one estimate, has 6 million homeless people, by another estimate,
a more prudent estimate, only 4.2 million people, in which the level of education has been raised to 5.5 years, average level of education to 5.5 years of schooling. I don't say this to induce bourgeois guilt, but to say that the problematic for us in the urban age is what, from a place like this, can we take to the places in the world whose cities are wildly expanding? Is there something about that we've learned from these projects or from the conditions in London that would help us to help people in places very different and much less endowed than our own? The last thing I have to say, which I wanted to say at the beginning, but I will do it at the end, is to thank the people who made this project possible. And I'll name them, and then we'll thank them with applause after that. First, to Emily Cruz and Karen England. Where are you? Show yourselves. Okay. Who did the effortless logistics of this conference. Amazing. And next, to Miguel Canay, Sarah Ichioka, and Philip Rhoda. Can you just raise your hands? This is embarrassing. There are more. Then to Bruno Moser and Ann Stevenson, who did the presentations. And I wanted to say about Bruno, whom I love embarrassing anyhow. But we need to thank him in particular for the wonderful graphics outside the hall, which describe the urban age, which are extraordinary. We need to thank Philip Rhoda and Ricky Burdett, of course, and the Herrhausen team. Where is the Herrhausen team? Exhausted in the back of their room. For all sorts of coordination from this conference to others. And finally, we need to thank Wolfgang Novak, who has presented the origins of this whole project in the most misleading, indeed dishonest light. It was Wolfgang's insight to see that we ought to do something elsewhere in the world that we were thinking about teaching in London. So our thanks, all of us, to you as well. So if you happen to be in Mexico City next February or March, let us know. Well, you want to have a final word?
It is very difficult to have a final word after 4 days of thinking. And I have written down some impressions. I'm not an urban practitioner. I'm not an architect, not a socialist. Maybe I've lived all my life in cities. Maybe I'm a victim of urban planning. But let me see some impressions I get. I was impressed how you tried just to solve the problems created by past generations of planners. And listening to the discussions, I was impressed about the unbroken ability to create new problems for future generations. My second remark is that I really like the British gentry when the British gentry is fighting against gentrification. At the same time, when hundreds and thousands of immigrants come to London to become part of the British gentry. I was impressed and filled with by the remarks of Saskia Sassen about in the time of the fading nation state, in the time of the doom of the nation, the post-national city emerged, and one day we will have networks of global cities part of the governance of the world. And to find out how they could govern, we have to find out about the DNA of cities, and that's what we are looking to. A very simple answer. Like writing, like language, cities are expression of humans, and the DNA of a city is a human DNA. I'm very proud to be part of this great project which we started last year, which we began this year in New York, and we survived the heat of Shanghai, and we survived the heat in this room. And I think it was a great conference, and I'm very proud and honored to be part of this urban age. And I think it's honored also the name of Alfred Herrhausen, the man who was looking for traces of the future and the present, and he was trying to think the 21st century at the end of the 20th century, at the same time when Germany was longing to go back to the 60s. And we are honored to have Anna Herrhausen with us, who is now part of the Urban Age team. Thank you, all of you, for this wonderful conference. Thank you to the mayor to show us the emptiness of power in this building. And thank you, and I can say auf Wiedersehen in Mexico.